I'm Beth.
I'm Holly.
And we're the Mombies.
You're in a house with at least four dead bodies in it.
Like, what is that?
How much worse can you get, really?
That's a great question.
Weird, just absolutely strange. How do you even do that?
I feel like that's gotta mean something.
Hello, spooky humans. Welcome back to the Mombies podcast. I'm Beth.
I'm Holly. I moved my mic right whenever you were talking, so sorry if that made a noise.
We haven't done this in a minute, so we've forgotten.
We're back.
We're still here, guys. We haven't forsaken you. I've been trying to get into a groove with Raj's new schedule on top of him not being able to drive anymore. So it's been really tough, but I'm trying. I love you guys. Thank you for sticking with us. I know you're still with us because you're absolutely still like on Facebook and everything and Instagram. So I know you're still with us.
We're figuring it out.
We understand. We're getting there. So if you follow us on Instagram, you already saw that we recently got the chance to check out Breakout Games' newest escape room here in St. Louis. We had to tell you guys about it. I don't know if we've told them how like we started doing escape rooms and stuff. So we started doing escape rooms back in, I think it was 2020, right?
Probably.
I think it was during the pandemic. Because back then all the rooms, well, I mean, they still are, but that's when they started doing rooms where it was totally private and you weren't with strangers. And we were like, yep, that sounds like.
Oh, hell yeah. And then after that, they were like, oh, we're just doing it like this all the time.
It was perfect.
And
so much better.
It makes so much more sense this way. I get they could make more money, but right. That
absolutely like,
no we did it with I guess we never did it with strangers, but we did do it once when you were there, right?
Yeah,
we did do it.
That was once. The first one we did.
Was it 12 of us or 12, 10 of us
10
it was
12, yeah.
An ungodly amount of people in this, but it was not right. A good time.
And we didn't all know each other either, so yeah. it was very hard. We were all yeah. kind of like talking over each other or not saying anything in the
right.
corner
so
with
imagining
me.
Doing that was if there's only four or six people that were strangers,
right? No, absolutely not. Nope. But now, because we did this in 2020, it's become a special activity that we do with Katie, who you guys have heard on the podcast a few times. We have done them with other people, but generally speaking, the three of us are like our little escape group. Now, Holly and I did Breakout's Kidnapped Room a while ago on my birthday. I guess it's been a couple years ago now, and we really enjoyed it. I remember walking in, and it was my birthday. So when we walked in, they told us we were going to be blindfolded and handcuffed. And I remember going, oh, it's my birthday too. And the girl was like, oh my God. So we just saw recently that they were opening Kidnapped 2. And, of course we were super stoked, and they finally opened it in St. Louis. It was amazing.
I loved it.
It was so good. We can't tell you a lot about it. Spoilers. But you do start out blindfolded and you're in a mostly dark room for the whole time. Like there's just a little bit of light, which gave a really good like spooky feel. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things that I really want to talk about for that, but obviously we can't. So you're just going to have to go do it.
Yeah. But then when you do it, you can message us and then we can yes. talk back and forth about our favorite parts.
Absolutely. And then we are seasoned escapees. So we set the record for the fastest time so far. Now this has been a week ago, so I don't know if we've been beaten or not, but in St. Louis, at least. Again, I don't know how that applies to the other locations.
Yep.
They are in 19 states. Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Maryland, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin.
And guess what? You're listening from all those states.
Right. You guys are in all of those states. And then also South Africa is listed on their website.
What?
But I don't see rooms there just yet. It looks like maybe they're opening one there.
Well, that's fucking incredible. I want to know
amazing.
The story behind that.
Also, we have listeners, or maybe it might just be listener. Hello, in South Africa. So you can go on there and like sign up for updates for South Africa, which is so fucking cool. So whoever you are, South Africa, hi. I don't know your name. I'm just going to call you South Africa. They're coming to you.
Room.
Please, please go to their room and then send us an email and just tell us all about yourself and all about your country and then all about your time in the room. So
yes,
when they open it there,
but go check them out because they're fucking great.
Yes. And Kidnap 2 isn't at every location, but it's at a lot of them. So mm-hmm. go check out their website, which is breakoutgames.com. See if it's available near you, book your room, and then share your picture with your time and tag us in it so we can see it on like Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah.
Or you can email your picture to us at mombieshorror@gmail.com so we can see your cute little faces and, you know, have a little competition back and forth.
I was going to say, and see if we kicked your ass or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we start on the episode, which we're trying to hurry because we're like squeezing in our recording between picking up kids and stuff. Before we start, we have a new patron that we have not talked about yet. Tori Fitch. Welcome.
Hello, Tori.
Welcome to the Mommy Outbreak.
We Tori likes to shit her pants just like us. So welcome to the show.
I hope y'all listen to that episode.
Oh my God.
Tori, you're awesome. And welcome.
Welcome.
Now that we've had all of our fun and laughing, this episode is going to be rough. Ooh. So I want to give you a trigger warning before we get started. We'll be talking about sexual abuse and murder of children. So I know that's rough. Not every podcast even covers cases that involve kids, but we think it's important.
Absolutely. And if you're from our area, you know who this is.
Yep. You recognize this one. You've already seen the names. So now there's two cases. I was going to cover just the one, but then as I was researching the other one, like hit me like a ton of bricks. I somehow had forgotten the name and then was like, oh my God, I remember that case. So, but I remember, the one case vividly from the time it happened because it's a local case and the victims are within a year of me age wise. While we were driving to Texas a few weeks ago for our little brother's wedding, Raj and I discussed what case to cover next. We kind of went back and forth a bit, and I don't remember how this one came up, but we just felt like this was the one. My main source for this episode was coverage of the case in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch spanning more than two decades. The most recent articles were written by Christine Byers, Kim Bell, and Joel Currier. And I do want to say, Christine Byers, her name comes up a lot in my research. It seems like she's a big name that covers true crime type stuff in our area. So, and she does a really great job. So just, you know, I don't know, the little props to Christine
Byers. Yeah, absolutely. And also, don't mind this fucking dog.
I know, right?
Barking its face off outside. As soon as we started, I feel like
fucker is out there all the time. Wah, 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 wah. So you guys can hear my neighbor's dog. sure you heard that. Great. Woo-hoo. It's fucking killing my ear right now. Now, so I want to take you back to the 1990s in the St. Louis area, or anywhere maybe, but. Now, when I say the St. Louis area, for if you're not familiar, I'm including the surrounding suburbs as well. Obviously, I didn't grow up in St. Louis. I grew up a couple counties over. So, now, at that time, for the younger listeners who don't know what it was like in the 90s, kids were sent outside to play with instructions to be home when the streetlights came on. Our parents didn't come outside and play with us. They just sent us into the world.
Yep. They had no idea exactly where you were, just somewhere in the neighborhood.
Exactly. That was my next point. There were no cell phones. There was no keeping track of what we were doing, where we were going, or who we were with. They just had to take our word for it. Mom, I'm going to Shanna's house or whatever.
Can you imagine? And I know that's just how it was. And had they had the technology that we have now, they would have used it. It would have been the same.
Of course.
But I'm a little bit of a helicopter parent anyways. So thinking of even my 10-year-old being somewhere where my eyeballs can't see it, I'm like, that's a hard pass.
I'm such a helicopter mom. It's insane. Fuck. I really am like, I'm not going to be a helicopter mom. I am yep. such, oh my God.
You want to go up the street? Cool. I guess we're all going up the street.
I try so fucking hard. Life was just drastically different than it is for kids today. When there were some benefits to that parenting style, I think, you know, I think that it made us independent in a different kind of way. I think that it taught us to do things that kids today maybe don't learn as quickly or don't learn at all.
Yeah.
I think it made us a little bit tougher in some ways. I do think the way that we're doing things now with emotions and stuff is much better, even though it doesn't seem like it to a lot of people. I think it's definitely the right way. But there were also some big drawbacks to this, just letting your kids roam free. By far the most sinister of those, of course, is the large number of high profile child kidnappings, disappearances, and murders during that time frame. Now, of course, almost all of the high profile cases involved white children, because the media doesn't cover children of color the same way, not because children of color were not being kidnapped or murdered.
Right.
Time frame. But I did put together a list of the most well-known cases. So that is why these cases are pretty much, I think there's one case that is not a white child. That's why. It's just because the high profile ones were white kids. And don't come at me if I missed a case. Online lists are not comprehensive by any fucking means. So in the St. Louis area, there was the 1988 disappearance of Scott Clayshalty, who has never been found. The 1991 disappearance of Arlen Henderson, who has never been found. The 2002 disappearance of Sean Hornbeck, who we discussed in episode 51. If you haven't listened, go back and listen to it. The 2005 disappearance of Bianca Piper, who has never been found. And the 2007 disappearance of Ben Ownby, who we also discussed in episode 51. I know that goes a bit before and after the 90s, but I felt like we needed to bring up those names specifically. In other states, there were even more. And again, I'll list just a few. The 1989 murder of Jacob Wetterling, the 1991 disappearance of J.C. Dugard, the 1993 murder of Polly Klass, the 1996 murders of Amber Hagerman, who we know because of the Amber Alert, and JonBenet Ramsey, the 2002 disappearance of Elizabeth Smart, the 2002 disappearance of Michelle Knight, who has since changed her name to Lily Rose Lee, the 2003 disappearance of Amanda Berry, and the 2004 disappearance of Gina DeJesus. And those last three, their story is intertwined, and we will eventually talk about that one. We've discussed telling that one quite a few times on here, but that one's going to be a really rough one. So we have to gear up for that one. And like I said, we'll definitely be covering probably all these cases at some point. The local ones, I'd really love to be able to get in contact with some of the families and get them to come talk with us. So, I wanted to kind of put in perspective that this was a lot happening in a fairly short amount of time when you consider what we're talking about. And these are just the high profile cases. So, you know, there's tons more happening throughout the country. I feel like that kind of sets the scene a little bit. So, you know, where we are, you kind of know what's going on. So are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Angela Marie Houseman was born February 18th, 1984 to parents, Diane Houseman and Angelo D'Andrea. Diane and Angelo had dated briefly before Diane became pregnant. Now, according to Angelo, Diane had ended the relationship. Her parents didn't want him around baby Angie, though Angelo says he wanted to be in her life. He only saw her a few times, and he held out hope that when she was older, they would get the opportunity to build a relationship. When Angie was around one, her mom began dating Ron Bone, who she would later marry. That's all the background that I have, but
okay,
that's what I've got. So on Thursday, November 18th, 1993, 9-year-old Angie got off her school bus on Wright Avenue in St. Ann, Missouri, around 4 p.m. She walked north in the direction of her family's duplex, just 8 houses from the bus stop. And I think 8 houses, I think it's like 4 buildings.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Because they're duplexes. So she never made it home. At that time, Angie's mom, Diane, was taking a nap with Angie's 2-year-old brother. Angie's stepfather, Ron, got home from work around 5 p.m. and woke Diane.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, right. There was no sign of Angie or her backpack at the house. Can you imagine?
No.
Being the mom and waking up to that and thinking that your daughter's in the house. And then she just never came home. Along with neighbors, they searched the neighborhood until a little after 7 p.m. And the newspaper said they flagged down a police officer. So I guess there just happened to be one driving by and they were like, hey, we need help. When Angie hadn't been found by the following evening, Diane had to be given a sedative just so she could get some sleep.
Oh, you're, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Those parents of trauma like this are superheroes.
How do you do that?
Because I would just be like a mute.
I feel like I'd be in one of those movies where, you know, someone's like like a mental hospital or something, and they're like pinning them down, trying to give them the sedative. Mm-hmm. I feel like that would be me, because I'd be like, I can't. I have to keep looking. Room. I can't. Yeah. There's no. Diane told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, I just hope to have her back as soon as possible so I can put my arms around her. In the days after Angie's disappearance, St. Louis County Police worked tirelessly to find her. Officers worked 18-hour shifts. They searched and they questioned anyone they thought might have some insight to where Angie could be. Angie's stepfather took a lie detector test, and I assume he was interviewed. They didn't really talk about that in the papers. Angie's biological father was interviewed multiple times for 3 hours at a time. Angie's mom was interviewed for at least close to 4 hours. They mentioned that, but they didn't talk about any other times.
Which is like, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
You get the reason why.
Yeah.
But the amount of fucking trauma that comes along with that, not only am I trying to find my child, but then you're pretty much interrogating me.
Right.
On the basis that I might have done it, and then what right. level that takes it to, I just
right. Well, and then cannot. You have to think on the police's end, like, how do you strike that balance? When do you know it's time to stop looking at the family?
Right.
And then you have to look at the family because, statistically speaking, it's most likely someone in the family or someone who knows the family.
Right.
So you have to look at the family, but also all that time that gets yep. wasted, and not intentionally, I'm not blaming the police at all by any means, but all that time that gets wasted unintentionally because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, but it's not the family right. this time.
And you have to push.
Right.
Because the proven facts that the more they push, the more people end up talking sometimes, right. you know? So I'm just like, oh.
I don't envy police mom. Officers being in this situation and trying mm-hmm. to investigate these kinds of cases. and it's very easy. I definitely, you know, have my own judgments about all kinds of stuff, my own opinions, but I don't envy police officers at all right. having to do all this. They use search dogs and helicopters equipped with infrared sensors in the search. I had a lot of trouble getting that sentence out. They searched nearby parks and vacant lots. Psychics even called in tips. Some said that Angie was being taken care of. Some said that she was safe, but afraid of coming home and getting a spanking. At least one said to search Bush Wildlife, a local wildlife reserve, about a half hour west of Angie's home, which they did do the Monday after Angie went missing. They didn't find her, and none of this seemed to bring them any closer to finding Angie. On day 5, the St. Louis Major Case Squad joined the investigation. Now, this was unusual. They have specific rules about which cases they work on, and it seems like they only investigate murders. At this point, this case was purely a kidnapping. In fact, Angie's disappearance was only the second time in 28 years that the Major Case Squad had helped on anything other than a murder.
Oh my gosh.
The only other exception at that time, there have been exceptions, or at least one exception since, but at that time, the only exception had been the rape of a 13-year-old girl in Maplewood in 1967. Florissant Police Chief Robert Lowry said the Angie Houseman case, quote, doesn't fit the criteria of the Major Case Squad rules, but we went with our hearts and not the written law of the bylaws. We're all fathers, some of us grandfathers, and we thought we had an obligation to this 9-year-old girl.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, as soon as you would have heard that, I'm sure her mother heart just exploded. Like, the fact that they were even coming there on it, and they deal with murders, you know, your right. brain goes somewhere right Absolutely. Away, and you're like, what the fuck?
Absolutely.
But then to know they're just there just to help. Just
to help. That's it. Doing what's right yeah. because that's what's right. Angie's disappearance, along with an attempted abduction in Maryland Heights a week earlier, changed how parents in the St. Louis area handled life with children. The parents in Angie's neighborhood were now taking turns meeting the bus and walking the kids home. I remember those changes as well. And I live roughly a 25-minute drive from Angie. You know where. Mm-hmm. Every time Holly drives past it, she sends me Snapchats of the house. Actually, I haven't gotten one in a while. My childhood best friend was the next house up from mine. And it was like a 400-foot walk from my door to hers because there was a street in between us. And before this happened, I don't remember it being a big deal for us to walk to each other's house. I don't remember my mom coming outside and like watching me walk up there or anything. But after this, I remember, you know, at least one of the moms would either come out and watch us walk, or they would both come out and watch us walk from one to the other. Or my mom started getting more in the habit of like taking me up and dropping me off in the car, and, mm-hmm. and it's 400 feet. So this was just a pretty big shift because the parents in the area were terrified. Then at 11:15 a.m. on Saturday, November 27th, a deer hunter at the August A. Bush Conservation Area, also known as Bush Wildlife, which I already mentioned, found the body of a young girl near a wooded ravine. In the early days, police refused to release any information about the crime scene. I didn't put it in here, but this was Angie. Sergeant Robert Lowry Jr. said, quote, it was a very violent act, but we're not going to divulge at this time how she was killed. The only information released then was that Angie had been killed where she was found, near Highway 94, just south of Highway 40. The St. Anne police chief also stated his belief that once they found Angie's killer, they would have an excellent case against him because of the physical evidence at the scene. But that was it. They didn't say what all that was. And in right. fact, I don't know that I've even seen now what all that was. On December 1st, so just a few days later, there was another shocking disappearance. 10-year-old Cassidy Center, who was born June 9th, 1983, to Rhonda and Jim Center, left her home in Hazelwood to walk to a friend's house at 3:30 p.m. The friends planned to hang Christmas lights. Cassidy's mom told her to be back home by 5, when it would get dark outside. Cassidy never made it to her friend's house, and the personal alarm she carried with her was found outside about a block from the friend's house 10 minutes later.
No.
Now, this alarm had a pin in it that the wearer would pull out to get it to make a sound if they were in trouble. Cassidy's mom had shown her how to do this, and obviously Cassidy had done exactly what her mom taught her. The frustrating detail here is that the alarm was found by a neighbor at 3:40 p.m., so again, 10 minutes after she left her house. The noise from it was so annoying that a telephone repairman in the neighborhood offered to tape it up.
No!
When that didn't work, it was buried in the yard of the guy who found it.
What? Does it have, like, information on it or anything? Like, what does it look like?
I don't know, but what the fuck? What? Wait. I was just like, okay, why would you not call the police?
Right.
I'm not judging those people. Hindsight's 2020, but also, like, what?
Like, there's this weird alarm thing.
Right, that I can't shut off.
Right.
That's strange. Now, the friends whose house Cassidy was going to just assumed that she had changed her mind, and they just went ahead and put up the lights, and they didn't call her mom. Cassidy's family didn't realize she was missing until around 5:10, which means she was missing by 3:40. And she didn't come back home. It wasn't like her to be late. So then they called the friend's house. When they learned that she'd never arrived, they immediately called police. Now, I'm not blaming that family. I'm not blaming that neighbor that buried the alarm. But if something seems off, just call. We should all live by the idea that we'd rather be safe than sorry.
And who just like buries random shit in their front yard?
Right.
Nothing of those people, but what a random ass thing to fucking do.
Such a weird thing. To me, I'd rather call the police and annoy them because I'm overreacting than not call and risk helping that perpetrator cover their tracks, like giving them that extra little bit of time. I'd rather call that mom and double check than risk anything being wrong. And that doesn't necessarily even mean an abduction. That means that if the lady up the street's daughter is coming to my house and doesn't show up, I'd rather call her and find out that she fell and got hurt, you know, and not leave her sitting outside. Right. Then risk something being wrong. You know what I mean? I'd rather just call and double check. I mean, and in Cassie's case, it would not have made a difference, as you'll find out, but it's just worth saying it. Like, don't just call. Just call. You may annoy the police, but that's fine. They'll be all right. They're big boys and girls. Now, Cassidy's disappearance bore similarities to both Angie's case and the earlier attempted abduction in Maryland Heights. All three girls were white. They were all about the same age. They were in close proximity to one another, and they were abducted or attempted to be abducted in the late afternoon. There were many other attempted abductions reported around the same time, but most of them were either determined to be hoaxes or they just never resulted in arrest. But quite a few, they said, were hoaxes. I guess kids trying to get attention is what they were saying.
Okay.
But by then, by the time all of this was out there and they figured out that these weren't really abduction attempts, area children were just fucking terrified too. The mother of one of Cassidy's best friends said, quote, "My daughter was petrified to go into our basement after she heard about Angie Houseman.
Oh,
that was her biggest fear, that it would happen to her. And now it's happened to her best friend."
No.
100 police officers searched for Cassidy over a 10-mile radius that included the area where Angie was found, but they didn't find her. Her father stood outside of a local church and handed out flyers to passersby. 2 days after Cassidy's disappearance, Angie's mom went to the center house and sat with Cassidy's mom, Rhonda. Diane said, quote, "I cried with her and she cried with me. I told her, just keep hoping till she's found. I told her she can call me whenever she wants. I tried to comfort her. I'm still hurting."
Oh my goodness.
On Thursday, December 9th, two teenage boys described as about 15 were walking in St. Louis and took a shortcut down the alley between Cass and Aldine Avenues. There in the alley, wrapped in two comforters and a pink curtain, was the body of Cassidy Center.
No.
Her jacket and sweater were pulled up above her chest. Her jeans were inside out and pulled down around her ankles. A bed sheet was looped around each of her ankles and tied together in the middle to hold them together. The boys called police from a payphone around 10 a.m. When the FBI investigated the crime scene, they found tire tracks with a unique pattern. They knew rain was coming in, so they worked as fast as humanly possible to get pictures and make casts of the tracks before the rain could wash them away, which is just fucking incredible.
Gosh.
One of these casts alone was nearly 6 feet long.
Yes.
These were later found to be from a Goodyear workhorse light tire truck. They also learned that someone had seen Cassidy lying there as early as 6 a.m., but had believed her body was a package of some sort. So we know she's dropped off before 6 a.m. And we have the tires. Now, so trigger warning. We're going to talk about her autopsy a little bit. Cassidy's autopsy revealed that she had at least 4 tears to her scalp and multiple skull fractures.
Oh, my gosh.
She had bruises on her chin, right cheek, right shoulder, breastbone, abdomen, each side of her chest wall, and on her upper back at the base of her neck, along with numerous others. Based on the condition of her scalp, it was determined that Cassidy was alive when she received many of her injuries.
Oh, my God.
She had received at least 5 blows to her head, and those were determined to be her cause of death.
Oh.
According to reporting at the time, Cassidy had not been sexually assaulted.
Oh.
Which is strange, because her pants have been obviously taken off and put back on inside
out. At that age, you would know.
Absolutely. On Saturday, December 11th, 2 Chicago area men were arrested and reported as potential suspects. The men were pulled over in North Riverside, Illinois, on either suspicion of stealing or because they had a loud muffler. I saw both reported. In the car, police found pornographic magazines and a book about the kidnapping of a girl.
What?
So they were arrested, but by that following Monday, the men had been released. And there were a lot of stories like that. I didn't include all of them, but there were a lot of them that was like, oh, we're interested in this person now. And it was some kind of loose potential connection, and then it ended up being nothing.
I guess, like we've said, I'd rather it be that than not absolutely pulling anybody in at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree completely. On Sunday, December 12th, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch released the FBI's profile of the killer or killers of Angie Houseman and Cassidy Center. The profile was the same for both.
Okay, I was going to say, are they thinking these are connected?
Yes.
Okay.
But either way, okay, the profile was the same for both. It suggested that the killer had recently begun living alone, with the newfound privacy giving him the ability to keep the victim captive without being caught. They believed the killer was a white man between 20 and 45 years old. They said he was likely a loner who had recently had a big stressor in his life, such as the loss of a job or a loved one. They said he was intelligent, but likely worked a job that didn't require much skill or showcase his intelligence. They also believed he had several cars that he switched between to avoid detection. The most chilling part of the profile was the belief that the killer wouldn't stop until he was caught.
Huh.
On Saturday, December 18th, 37-year-old Gary H. Stuffelbean, an auditor from Texas, was arrested for the attempted kidnapping in Maryland Heights. Police were led to him when they tied him to a white rental car with a license plate that matched a partial given by a witness.
Oh.
Now, they immediately began looking into Stufflebean's movements to see if he'd been in the area when Angie and Cassidy were abducted. Stufflebean passed a voice stress test when questioned about the murders, but police remained skeptical of his story. By the end of the year, Stufflebean had admitted to molesting 3 other girls over the past 12 years, but he remained adamant that he'd had nothing to do with the kidnappings and murders of Angie and Cassidy. He blamed his urges to do things to children on stressors in his life, such as marital problems and his wife having an affair.
I'm sorry. What the fuck did you just say?
I know, right? It's like, what?
I'm sorry. I'm fighting with my wife, so... Yeah, that's obviously the next step when you're fighting with your spouse.
Is to go molest kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Obviously. No.
I couldn't do it. I've just beat the shit out of you, and now I'm fired because I just beat the shit out of you because you just said something dumb.
Yep. Well, that's one of the reasons I'm not going to be a police officer. His confession included the 11-year-old that I've already mentioned, who he pulled into the bushes and fondled before attempting to lead her to his car. The fondling of another 11-year-old in the bedroom of a friend's house in St. Louis 5 years prior. The molestation of a young girl in North Carolina 9 years prior. And the sexual assault of a girl in St. Louis 12 years prior. So these are the girls that he's admitted to. The attack from 5 years earlier was confirmed by the child's father, and the attack from 12 years earlier was confirmed and given added detail by the victim herself.
Oh.
3 more women also came out and accused Stufflebean of sexual assault after his name hit the news.
Even that's why, though, that you still try to get everyone and look at everyone, because now at least you've caught some other fucking psycho gross guy off of the street.
Absolutely. On January 5th, Gary Stufflebeam was released on bond and ordered to wear an ankle monitor while he awaited trial. Prosecutor Robert McCullough said that Stufflebeam was, quote, a great danger to the community. He also expressed his distrust in the ankle monitor system, stating that it wouldn't stop Stufflebeam from grabbing another girl.
That's what I was just thinking. Like, you just said he's a great risk to society, but you fucking let him out. Here, wear this bracelet.
Right. Well, he didn't let him out. Somebody said he was a great danger, and somebody else was like, nah, fuck it, let's give him this bracelet to wear. During this time, Gary's wife was combative with the media, calling reporters bastards and shoving a TV cameraman that approached her. She or someone else in the family also called police on a neighbor that picketed with a sign that said, quote, not in my neighborhood, but were told that she had a right to be there. I don't totally blame her, because she probably genuinely believed her husband was innocent.
Yeah.
And she was probably trying to protect her daughter, because they had a daughter.
Yeah, that's a hard spot. Oof.
But also, I just was like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Your husband admitted to... And I know people will confess to things they didn't do.
But right.
I just was like, will you stop?
Mm-hmm.
2 days after his release, it was announced that Gary Stufflebeam had been cleared in the murders of Angie Houseman and Cassidy Center. That evening, the mother of the Maryland Heights girl knocked on the door at Gary's mother's home and asked to speak to Gary. Gary's wife had words with the woman, and the two shoved each other for a bit. Unfortunately, that's all the information that was reported. I really would have loved to have more to see on that situation.
Fucking right, doggy. I'm her.
I'll
straight up knock on your fucking front door.
I don't really want his wife to get hit, because she didn't do it.
Right.
But I also really hope that mom got a good punch in.
Mm-hmm. Listen, get out of my way, Linda.
You're going to move so I can punch your fucking husband, or I'm going to knock your teeth out.
Yeah.
And I'm not advocating violence, but...
I've warned you and I've asked you.
If I've knocked on that door, look, I'm going to give you a chance. And then I'm going to count to five.
Right.
And I'm going to punch on four.
Everybody's ass, even grandma's. That's
right.
Move.
That's right. Get the fuck out of my way. Take your daughter out back and go smoke a cigarette or something. Right. Or tell her about
give
the stars.
Give me 2 seconds.
And let me punch your husband. It's not your fault, but... In May 1995, Gary Stufflebeam was sentenced to 5 years in prison thanks to a plea deal in which he agreed to enter a guilty plea. He would also go through an 18-month treatment program for sex offenders while incarcerated. During the hearing, the judge was asked to consider letters of support, which is just irritating me because I'm also in the middle of watching Quiet on Set, so of support.
I get that we have to do this, but it's still really fucking stupid. So if you just admit to the really fucked up, horrible shit that you did, then we'll give you a leaner sentence for the thing that you did.
Right.
That you're guilty of.
Mm-hmm.
Just say it.
I
get it. Don't everybody come at me. Right. I get it. I fucking get it.
I get the point.
But it's fucking stupid.
I understand how it's useful as a bargaining tool.
Yeah. But now everybody knows there's a bargaining tool. So I can fuck off and do whatever I want. And then if I just be like, oh man, yeah, I really did that. If I tell you I did it, then you're going to get me off easier.
Right.
How about no?
I don't know. How about
here's your DNA.
I tell you I did.
You're fucked.
How about we say that I'm going to give you a lighter sentence and then I just don't.
And then I fucking don't. Because you fucking kill people.
Because I can say whatever I want to.
Yeah.
I don't think
people are like, how dare you? You can't lie to them.
Really? Shouldn't lie to them.
But also, if I'm innocent, I don't want them to be allowed to lie to me. So it's kind of
that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about guilty people.
Only. I know, but there's innocent people in there too. That's my problem. Because I know that if I go in there and I'm innocent, then they're going to fucking lie to me too. And I'm going to be like, I don't know, they were lying. I said he would go through the 18 months. Okay, so during the hearing, the judge was asked to consider letters of support written by Gary's wife, his daughter, his sister, his mother, his counselor, and 200 friends and acquaintances. I'm sorry. How many people wrote to tell you the child molester was fine?
No. If one thing has happened that your wife, and I'm like, maybe this didn't really happen.
Right.
No way. You didn't do that.
Right.
But this thing comes out.
Right.
There's like seven fucking things.
Right.
That he's, number one, pled guilty to.
Right.
But that are on the table. I'm not writing shit. Actually, I am. This guy is a piece of shit. We are getting divorced. Put him in prison.
Go the fuck end. Yourself. Just right. give this straight to my ex-husband.
Not after one thing where you're like, you don't know what to believe, but that many and him saying he did it. I'm not. No.
Right. No.
No.
Absolutely not.
And also, I love my child. No.
Right.
I'll come visit
you. I'm protecting
you.
My child and her friends.
Yeah.
By getting her away from my ex-husband, mm-hmm. who apparently was abusing a little girl. So that's what I'm going to do. Again, I'm not judging his wife.
No.
I'm just, it's...
Holy shit.
Hindsight is 2020, and I'm not in that relationship, so I absolutely have opinions.
And also, even if you are a air quotes, good person, because you can't be fucking both.
Right.
Can't touch children and be a good person. That doesn't exist. But I fucking lost my train of thought on that. God damn it.
Shit. I hate that. Happens to me a lot.
All right, keep going.
All right, I'll keep going. So those letters were not quoted in the paper, which is good because I don't really want to fucking read them anyway.
Yeah.
But the letter from his victim in Maryland Heights was, she said, quote, "I really, really feel that Gary Stufflebean is a danger to society. I am afraid of this man, not only for myself, but for my friends, family, and other kids."
Oh.
I didn't really have to talk about that case, but I just was like, we got to talk about this.
Oh, absolutely.
The elimination of Gary Stufflebean left police without a suspect. They'd cleared over 600 people in the investigation at this point. While they still had some promising leads, the question of who could have taken these innocent girls remained unanswered. The task force cut the number of officers working on the cases in half because there just weren't enough leads to justify having so many. This raised concerns that the cases might go unsolved, but the smaller workforce didn't stop the determination to give these girls their justice. In mid-January, the evidence from Angie and Cassidy's cases were sent to the FBI, along with evidence from a third murder that had been committed in October. Fuck, I forgot to look up how to pronounce this girl's last name. I'm so sorry if I pronounce it wrong. I just realized I forgot. Although the victim in that case, 20-year-old Amy Bohn, it's B-O-H-N, I'm so sorry if I pronounce it wrong, was much older at 20 than Angie and Cassidy at 9 and 10, police felt that there were some similarities between the three. They hoped that the FBI could determine if any of the cases were connected and provide some further insight. Then on February 4th, 1994, it was announced that a suspect had been arrested in the murder of Cassidy Center.
Oh.
27-year-old Thomas Brooks Jr. was charged with first-degree murder, kidnapping, attempted rape, and armed criminal action. Brooks is
27 years old.
27
what
years old.
What a fucking waste.
Brooks's sister, Cassandra Quinn, and her boyfriend, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name either, sorry, LaFrance Wilson, were also arrested and charged with hindering prosecution. Brooks had been interviewed earlier in the investigation and had remained on police radar. He lived in the house part-time with his sister, her six, I think it was, kids, and her boyfriend. The house was just two doors down from the yard where Cassidy's alarm was found.
No. What?
So it was someone who was right there and just...
So she could have just been, like, in that house?
Yes. But they think she died very quickly once she was in the house. So I don't, even if they had looked right there right then... I think by the time they found her, it would have been too late. They might have found him faster, but I don't think they would have saved her. They think she was dead within 10 minutes of being inside the house. It was very quick, which is horrible, but also I hope that that means it was I don't know. I just hope that she didn't suffer.
That would just ruin you even more that it was right there.
Yeah, right
she
there.
Was right there.
She was right
there. He was right there.
Right there the whole time. Brooks had given the alibi that he'd been at work at a local McDonald's when Cassidy disappeared. 2 days before Cassidy's body was found, police had gone back to Brooks' sister's house and spoke with Quinn and Wilson, so his sister and her boyfriend, who said they didn't know anything about the case. Police returned to the home 2 more times in December, but Quinn and Wilson maintained they didn't know anything. There were stories in the paper about tracking dogs alerting on the porch of the house, a bad smell coming from the house that led to a story about like a broken fridge and rotting fish or something.
Give me a fucking
break. And then Cassandra refusing to let police into her house as well. But all of those stories apparently were not true. This was according to the Taylor's County Police Chief. All right. I wanted to address it because I was like, there are probably other podcasts that might talk about that and think it's true. None of those things apparently were true. And that's from the police chief, from like an announcement he made or whatever. Police were led back to Brooks when a hair sample taken from Cassidy's body was found to be from a black man. I've already mentioned that until this point, police believe that Cassidy's killer was a white man. So this new information had really changed the whole direction of the investigation. And there were even articles before they found him where there were people in the black community saying like, oh, they're just going to think this is a black guy now because of where she was left. She was left in the city. And then it turns out she actually was killed by a black man. So it was just this crazy, like, I don't think anybody saw that coming. Because this is a little white girl.
Right.
Was probably killed, first of all, probably by a white guy, because there's a lot of white guys that are pedophiles. But not all white guys, right. But still. Like, mm-hmm. Anyway, but I just think nobody saw that coming. So I did want to point out that one detective was said to have liked Brooks for the suspect from day one. That detective was quoted as saying, quote, a record check showed that Brooks had once lived in the 3700 block of Cottage Avenue. That's four blocks from where Cassidy's body was dumped. Oh. That detective's name? Joe Burgoon.
Ah, Burgoon!
I was like, Burgoon! Gosh, hold on. I think we're going to have to stop there.
All right.
I started recording right when you said.
So Katie's here now.
Right. So we were recording between dropping kids off and picking kids up, and then we ran out of time. So we stopped. So I don't know how much that will delete or what we'll do, but we're back now.
Yeah, that probably makes no sense.
Right. Too. And now we have a special guest who we literally mentioned at the beginning of the episode. So welcome, Katie. Yeah,
hi. And I have not heard the beginning of the episode aside from the synopsis of this current case. So I don't know in what context you were using my name.
The escape room.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about doing the escape room together.
Apparently, Holly also didn't remember what you were saying.
She was like, you talked about Katie?
She goes, oh.
I was going to like say something snarky and silly, but be like, we were talking shit about you. We were
talking about your sweet ass.
No.
No, wasn't that?
Oh. Listen, Linda, if you're going to be on the show, you're going to need to get your life together.
We're literally recording in the dark, guys.
And there's so much shit in this room because Mother's Day is coming up, and I just threw it all off of the pod table.
She must have just swept it all off. I came in here, and there was stuff everywhere, and I came back in. I was like, that was very quick.
Just a little tiny circle for us. Don't move or you'll kick something.
Listen, the lights are dark, so all I can see is my fucking computer screen. Because I'm staring at a bright light, so it's just like everything else around it is dim. And I don't know what they can see, but probably me.
We can see your whole fucking face.
Oh, good. If I start like picking my nose or something. Oh, yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay,
Big Bear left cave.
I'm just kidding.
Oh my god.
I was gonna say, wherever else you want to.
We're a giant train wreck, guys. It's not because we don't care about these cases, I promise. It's just because it's who we are. That's why you love us. So, we were talking about Thomas Brooks. So once Brooks was in custody, he confessed, telling police at first that Cassidy had approached him looking for sex.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Pause for dramatic effect.
That's very 90s of you.
He literally told them that a 10-year-old approached him looking for sex.
Jesus.
This sweet little baby 10-year-old girl.
So he's telling the police this?
That's what he originally told them.
Oh my gosh. No.
Yeah. Then he changed it to that he'd been home when Cassidy had knocked on the door to see if his nephew could play. Which...
And how far away is this from... where she was supposed to be?
This was between her house and the other house. I mean, so this is a block away from where she was supposed to be. She was on her way there, and she must have stopped at his house, or he grabbed her without her stopping at his house. I'm not sure. So trigger warning, I'm going to tell you what he said happened to Cassidy. Brooks told police that Cassidy had come to the door to see if his nephews were home. He said he grabbed her by the hand and dragged her inside and down the basement steps. He said Cassidy had fallen down the steps, triggering her personal alarm. He said he then took the alarm, went back upstairs, and threw it into the street. So he just, like, chucked it out the fucking window.
Okay.
While it's going off. You know, he was too busy trying to fucking hurt a 10-year-old little girl. He went back to the basement, and he told Cassidy to remove her pants. Cassidy was screaming and trying to find a way out of the house or out of the basement. He admitted to trying to rape the 10-year-old girl, but Cassidy fought him so hard that he decided he had to kill her instead. Oh, wow. He beat her in the head 4 times with a wooden bed slat. Jesus. Cassidy was dead within 10 minutes of being inside the house.
No.
I don't think her alarm was triggered from falling down the steps. I think she pulled the pin. Probably. After murdering Cassidy, Brooks covered her with curtains and a comforter, called a cab, and went to work, clocking in at 4 p.m.
Wow. Okay.
And who else is in the house? So this is who, this is, she's in the bedroom.
So she was in the basement.
She's in the basement. And he tells her not, his girlfriend not to go.
So this no. That's no. So this is, so he lives with his sister and her boyfriend.
Oh yes. Okay. Yes.
And her kids. One place said she had 4 kids, and another thing said 6. And I determined that I think it was 6, but I don't remember why I determined that. But it was either 4 or 6 kids.
She's got a few children.
She does. She has a few children. Sure. And so, I don't know that anybody was home when that happened. I think everybody was probably out of the house when that happened. But you'll see, we'll talk about where their involvement comes in. Because as I said, the sister and her boyfriend were arrested. So my next sentence. Either that evening or the next day, Brooks' sister found the body in the basement and told him she didn't want to know anything about it. He just needed to get rid of it.
What the fuck?
This is his sister.
The mother of
multiple
children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you would know that it was, would she have known it was a child, or she's covered up? So I mean, maybe she,
you're right. I don't know what she would have seen, but I mean, she's a sweet little baby 10-year-old girl. She was so fucking cute. Yes. I think you would know.
So I can see why she got arrested then.
This is 10-year-olds from the 90s, not 10-year-olds and what they look like today, which is different, I feel like. Like, is that just me?
Yes.
Very grown.
So, you know, she looked like a 10-year-old little girl.
So ugly when I was 10.
We're not.
We were absolutely not. We're living
our best fucking lives. We were just talking about this. Not giving a shit. I'm pretty sure I had
cornrolls.
About
you've never been ugly a day in your life.
Not giving a shit about nothing. Don't worry about makeup. You don't got to worry about what clothes you're wearing. You're just going to go outside and get
just jutting out of every space.
Yes. And so, you know what? But so is everyone else here.
Right.
But being a kid is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So she told him she didn't care what he did. He just needed to get rid of it. On December 9th, Brooks rented a U-Haul, which he then drove to work before going home and using the dolly to load Cassidy into the back of the truck. At 4 a.m. on the 9th, he took Cassidy to the alley. It sounds like I'm saying Cassie, but I swear I'm saying Cassidy. Although I think she might have gone by Cassie. Maybe that's why it's coming out that way. So she was found there later that day. Brooks' sister purchased ammonia and bleach to clean the basement after Cassidy's body was moved. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So.
Something else is already happening there, too, because, why? How?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I love my brother. I don't know about fucking covering up for him if I found a body in the basement.
No.
I don't think about that would be happening. Certainly not if it was a 10-year-old girl.
Now you guys, we already have plans.
Do what?
I said now for you guys, we already have plans.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be a 10-year-old girl.
Oh, God.
That's, I think
that's, I wasn't even thinking that.
That's where part of where I'm like, I think I'm even, I'm like, I'm not that I'd be like, I want to cover him for my brother, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's it, you found a child in your basement, like, I, not I could see, but I could see like. You walk in and you find that, I don't know, he killed some friend of his or something. I'm not saying that you should cover up for the person. I'm just saying, like, I could see the train of thought going that way more so then.
It might be a little less shocking.
Exactly. You're talking about a child that you just walk in and this little girl is in your bait. No. Nope. Not covering for shit. They'll be waiting for you when you get home.
We're about to bury two bodies.
Right.
Sure.
So there was a lot of circumstantial evidence tying Brooks to Cassidy's murder, you know, in addition to the fact that he confessed. The FBI was able to confirm that the tire tracks found in the alley were a match to the type of tire on the U-Haul Brooks had rented, and paint chips found in the sheets wrapped around Cassidy's body were a match to the paint on the dolly in that truck. Okay. Neighbors told police that they had seen the U-Haul in Brooks' driveway the morning Cassidy was found, and Brooks had actually hit the corner of his sister's house and knocked down a neighbor's mailbox with the truck. The pin from Cassidy's personal alarm was found in the basement of Brooks' sister's house. And a broken-off piece of the gate between the driveway and the backyard was found inside the blanket that was wrapped around Cassidy's body. Okay. The piece had broken when it got caught on the blanket as Brooks was moving Cassidy to the truck.
Well, that's a lot of things.
So there were quite a few things that tied him to it. In late 1994, both Quinn and Wilson, it's the sister and her boyfriend, were sentenced to 3 years in prison for their role in covering up the crime. Then in September 1995, Thomas Brooks was
found. How many?
3 years. They each got 3 years.
For what?
All they just lied to police. That was really their part of it, was saying we didn't know anything that's happened with this case. So I guess because they didn't take part. Yes, I know that.
You cleaned it up. You saw her.
So that's funny. I was actually kind of thinking differently. Like 3 years, that's some decent time. Not enough, I agree. But that's some decent time. Like, think about, okay, spoiler alert for Quiet on Set. But think about that guy that molested... Like, and it was proven. He had, like, 18 months.
Mm-hmm. And they said there, too. I think we were watching that.
He raped a child.
I think it was when we were watching that. And I think they say in the documentary something about what a short time he got. And literally, I looked at Raja and was like, they were saying, like, cases that get this, they get these short times. And I was like, yeah, like, fucking that rapist, Brock Turner, that got 6 months and served less than four or something.
So I'm like, three. I completely agree. Those people are awful. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, I figured it'd be like, you got to do some community service work,
right?
You know, or something like that, because that's just how things, that's how it feels like they go.
In September 1995, Thomas Brooks was found guilty and sentenced to death by lethal injection. He refused to show up for the sentencing hearing, which I don't even fucking understand how could you do that?
I didn't know why is that even allowed?
Right. Your choice? Unless you're unconscious.
Bring your fucking ass to court and get your sentence.
Yeah.
Jackass.
What the fuck?
I was like, that's strange, but okay.
We'll mail you your consequences.
Right.
Oh my god. What the fuck?
Fucking crazy.
I don't wanna go.
Right.
Just calling.
Absolutely not. Get your ass in the fucking police wagon with your fucking handcuffs on.
Police wagon. Yeah.
I don't know. That's what came to my mind. I'm tired. It's been a long day already.
The paddy wagon.
Thank you.
I got you.
That was good.
That's not what they're fucking driving in 1993, obviously, but it's just.
Oh, the 1900s of it all.
That's what came to my mind. Look, I'm reminded a lot that I'm old. Yes.
All right.
While awaiting his execution at the Moberly Correctional Center, 33-year-old Brooks died.
That's right, because this was all around here.
Yes, it was. I was like, where is she going with this? Yes, it was all around here. This is St. Louis. So 33-year-old Brooks died of AIDS on May 16th, 2000.
What?
Yep. His autopsy showed that he was suffering from AIDS, liver failure, emphysema, and a form of lung disease. And I'm not sad for him.
No!
that's probably the perfect ending. You're right. Mm-hmm.
I hope it hurt a lot.
He did not get...
No.
How far... Was that even on the table yet? Because, you know, you get on death row for forever.
Oh,
was
yeah.
Is this close to that time or no?
So, you know, whenever, like, somebody makes an off-color joke about, like, I hope you die of AIDS. Like, he actually did.
Yeah.
Nice.
He was only in prison for 5 years before he died of AIDS. But I mean, hopefully he died a pretty
painfully,
pretty painful that bad death.
Not so good.
I mean, all of that sounds terrible. Liver failure, emphysema. I hope he felt like he couldn't breathe. I hope, mm-hmm. I hope that's what it felt like every day. I hope he just.
Was, I hope like, that struggling just for air. Gave her parents whatever closure they needed. Yeah. Like. However that person goes, I hope it's what, like, her parents
did she have any siblings?
Want.
Cassidy, yeah. I don't believe she did. I could be wrong, but I don't believe she did. Ugh. I didn't find anything about any siblings. Angie had a 2-year-old brother, and then her parents were divorced, or no, excuse me, were never married, but her mom, she had a stepdad who had been in her life her whole life, and they had some children together as well. So I think she had a few younger brothers, but only one of them was alive when she was killed.
Oh, God. Could you imagine parenting a 2-year-old after your 10-year-old was just murdered?
No, he'd never.
That would take helicoptering to a new level.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And it would be so hard for everyone because,
Now, although police had assumed the same person murdered both Angie and Cassidy, they quickly realized that this theory was wrong. Angie's killer was still out there. A few days after the announcement of
Brooke's... Because at that point, it's because they had DNA on Angie that didn't match. That's how they're ruling that out?
Probably.
Okay.
I would assume so.
Okay.
A few days after the announcement of Brooke's arrest, a new sketch was released of a person of interest in Angie's case. The man was described as a white male of average height between 38 and 45. He was heavy set with thick wavy brown hair and deep set eyes. His car was described as possibly being a faded blue older model sedan in generally good condition.
Definitely.
And then this came from carpet fibers found at the crime scene, and they were matched with an older model car.
Love technology.
And then 5 different people had seen this man in the area on 3 different days. And as police investigated, they determined that he was not from the neighborhood. So... Yeah.
So at least 3 different people were like, yeah, that guy's creepy as
fuck. Yeah, yeah, something's wrong with that guy and that blue car that just keeps driving down the street creepily. Whatever he was doing.
I'm not kidding. I always be vigilant. That's why, though. But today, mm-hmm. I was driving to go get the kids from school. And I, like, passed this little, there's this one little turn that doesn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little ending of the street. You'd have to just turn around and come back up in the neighborhood. And when I drove by, there was this truck that was turning, and it was obviously there before I was. So it mm-hmm. should have gone. And I just kept, like, waiting it out, and they finally went. And when I passed, there was a kid just, like, sitting at the end of the street on this driveway. And I was like, huh, just like looking over there, but there's a house down there. And it wasn't like a tiny kid or anything. Mm-hmm. I literally took a picture of the truck in front of me. Because I was like, what if I just need to know about this truck? Like, my brain just automatically goes there. So I was just just took a picture of it.
I mean, that's how Michael Devlin was caught.
That picture. No. Good right. job.
That's how Michael Devlin was caught, is because the kid saw him turning around and he thought it was weird. Right.
And it seemed like a much older person in there. But I was just kind of like looking around and looking at the kid. The kid looked fine, but I was like, what were you doing over there?
Right.
Why are you on this road?
I told Roger the other day that I'll do that. Like,
right.
If something looks...
My knee.
I told Roger the other day that, like, if I see something that looks strange or off, I'll try to make a mental note.
Yeah.
Like, that didn't look right.
Mm-hmm.
What did that guy look like?
Yeah.
Or what did that car look like? Or what time is it? What time did I hear that? Like, which is fucking dumb. I'm probably not going to remember it the next day, but I still am, like,
that's true.
Trying to make notes of stuff. Because I think I'm a fucking badass crime solver, I guess. I don't even fucking know.
Like Sherlock Holmes.
That's right. That's what I think I am. Or Batman. World's greatest detective. I wish I had his money, but...
I'm Batman.
I'm just good at figuring stuff out sometimes.
Well!
On March 31st...
Let's get back to the child murder, please.
Yes. Let's get back to what's happening here. 1994. The Post-Dispatch reported that a new suspect had emerged. John Wayne Parsons had taken film to be developed near Tampa, Florida, and the store's owner noticed that the pictures were of children in provocative poses. She contacted police, who raided Parsons' home and found hundreds of pornographic photos, along with clippings about Angie and Cassidy's deaths.
Oh, that's fucking gross.
Right. Now, Parsons obviously lived in Florida, but he'd been in St. Louis for the funeral of a grandparent at the time of Angie's abduction.
Oh, no.
Parsons was arrested on charges involving sexual abuse of some other minors, and the major case squad obtained warrants for hair and blood samples to see if he was a match for Angie's killer. Unfortunately, on April 5th, it was announced that the samples taken from John Wayne Parsons weren't a match to Angie's killer.
Our poor parents. Oh.
I know. There's a lot. Like I mentioned before, there's a lot of that where it's like, oh, they think it's this guy. Oh, no, it's not that guy. Oh, we think it's this guy. Oh, no, it's not this guy. Where was the funeral? I don't have any idea.
We should look into that. Mm-hmm. What if the funeral was in, what is it, August? What the fuck is the name of the park?
Bushwala?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if the cemetery's in there? Oh, there were cemeteries in there. I peed by one. Don't tell anyone.
Let's talk about her peeing. That's all she's...
I'm just saying.
No, but he's not tied to her.
Yeah, he's not tied to her.
Okay. Fine.
By DNA. Or I'm like, absolutely, I'm...
Even if he's not tied to her, what if it still was a cemetery in Bush Wildlife?
That would be crazy. That'd be
pretty interesting.
It is crazy to think, too, that we were there not all that long ago, too.
We were. It's true. What's this guy's name again?
This guy? Mm-hmm. John Wayne Parsons.
She's like, let me just look this up. Side hustle.
She's going to do that. So I think Sergeant Riley Hughes, who was heading the major case squad's effort to catch Annie's murderer, summed it up best when he said, quote, "This is the most frustrating case I've encountered in my 30 and a half years as a policeman." Ugh. The major case squad even went so far as to obtain access to satellite photos of the area where Angie was left in hopes of catching a glimpse of her murderer's car. Like, they really just tried everything. Unfortunately, thanks to an overcast sky, the day Angie was left to die in the woods, this was yet another long list of leads that went nowhere.
No.
On September 15th, 1994, police announced that they'd found what they believed to be the car used in the abduction of Angie Houseman. I assume this was the blue sedan I mentioned earlier, but tests didn't match the evidence in Angie's case, and it was just another thing that came and went.
Fuck.
That November, just shy of a year since Angie's disappearance, police gave more information on what happened to Angie. Remember, up until this point, they had kept pretty much everything very close to the chest as far as autopsy results and things like that. There's not a lot of detail, just a brief overview. First, they said that Angie was taken to an unknown location where she was raped. She was held captive for 8 days and wasn't given any food or water during that time.
No.
On day 8, Angie was taken to Bush Wildlife and tied to a tree. She was naked. When Angie was found at 11:15 a.m. on day 10, she had been dead only a few hours. Which is fucking devastating.
Who found her?
A hunter.
I was just going to say, I can imagine myself just being out fucking finding mushrooms. Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a, like just such a what if, like, if only someone had found her sooner. If they had found her, you know, how many hours sooner could she have been okay?
And knowing, too, that they had been out there before.
Right.
And not knowing at that time that it just, obviously, she wasn't there yet. But you wouldn't have known at the very beginning. So that would just,
But it's just that, I mean, that's like, I think one of the most gut-wrenching things about this. Obviously, everything that happened to her is horrible and everything else. But just knowing that if only someone had been there just a little bit sooner, she could still be here. She could be okay. She could be, you know, a grown-up dealing with severe trauma. But she could have gotten to grow up and live her life and be here. And it just sucks. When her hands were bound behind her back with metal handcuffs. Her eyes were covered with duct tape that wrapped around her whole head. A separate piece covered her mouth. Mm. And they said that there was snow on her body. So, I mean, it was very cold and snowy. Mm-hmm. And she was alone in the woods with her eyes covered. Couldn't even see what was going on. After the release of this new information, the case went cold. In November 1997, the nurses of a man named Bryant Squires reported that he'd given a deathbed confession to helping kidnap Angie and holding her hostage along with an accomplice before his death in September 1996. He stated they had been scared off by passersby after tying her to the tree. He also confessed to a slew of other crimes, including the kidnapping and murder of Gina Dawn Brooks in August 1989 in Fredericktown, Missouri. It was reported that, quote, much of what the nurses have related from Squires has proven accurate and true. However, he couldn't be tied to Angie's kidnapping. Squires is just one in a long list of names of men who were thought to be suspects through the years, but, like I said, were ruled out. Although the case was cold, Angie's story remained heavy on the hearts of the people of St. Louis. So we're going to take a pretty good size jump ahead here. That's November 1997.
It's been a year.
That Parsons guy, though, was a real piece of shit. Like, I was just reading this news article. Mm-hmm. May I? Is that okay?
Yeah.
What is this from? St. Louis region?
Okay.
What is this?
Just a St. Louis paper?
St. Louis Post-Dispatch. So, it's talking about how the FBI lab results don't match the slaying suspect. So, they're talking about Angie. And then they talk about how, so that Parsons guy was of interest, at least on three separate occasions, but he was found in Florida arrested for child molestation. So he had molested two girls in Bradenton, Florida, and a 7-year-old girl in Potosi, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Or is there a Potosi, Florida? It doesn't say, it just says
Potosi. No, I think it's Potosi, Missouri, I would assume.
And he admitted to it, like, what the fuck? So, like, this guy is a child molester. Yeah. So, like, those people that were like, hey, that creepy fuck over there, something's not right. Yeah, something wasn't right.
Right.
Regardless of if he's associated with Angie or not. But right. It sounds like it's definitely a possibility.
Right, absolutely. So, Holly, and you said a year. So, at this point, when that man gave the deathbed confession, that was November 1997.
Oh, you said 1997. So, it had been 4 years.
But we're going to take a big leap forward. Okay. November of 2016.
No, that's so far away.
I mean, that's like 23 years, I think. I tried to do the math in my head. Angie's mother, Diane, died of cancer without seeing justice for her only daughter.
I'm just going to ask that. Yeah. Are her parents still alive?
So that was November 2016, and again, the case is so cold. So nothing is changing. March 1st, 2019. DNA from Angie's underwear matched to a 61-year-old convicted pedophile named Earl Webster Cox. Cox's name wasn't entirely new to investigators, as he'd been included on a list of about 1,400 names of people who had been arrested in the area 4 years into the investigation. So they had seen his name, but because of different jurisdictions and things, they hadn't seen the things he had done. So I don't think they realized that maybe this guy could be an interesting suspect.
Yeah.
The list had been compiled by the FBI. So it's not really known further why he wasn't, or known publicly why he wasn't further investigated. That's just my guess, is that, you know, jurisdiction difference and stuff like that. Now, for Cox, he grew up in the St. Louis area, and he enlisted in the Air Force in 1975. In 1982, he was dishonorably discharged after being convicted in a court-martial proceeding of molesting 4 girls he babysat on base while stationed in Germany.
Oh, my God.
All 4 were between the ages of 7 and 11. He returned to the St. Louis area after being paroled in 1985. He had been questioned in 2 child molestation incidents, one resulting in an arrest for assault in Overland just 4 years before Angie's murder. In Overland, which is very close to St. Anne.
Yeah.
Now, that attack was on 2 7-year-old girls, and it took place in a park behind Angie's elementary school.
Okay.
The charges were ultimately dropped, but the arrest caused his parole to be revoked, and Cox was returned to federal custody from January to December of 1992.
Why December did he not 92. Just stay there for forever?
Because that's not how that works.
What the fuck?
Obviously, something is not right with this person.
Right. When he was released, he gave his mother's address in St. Anne, half a mile from Angie's home. Mm. Angie was murdered 11 months later.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't living with his mother at the time. He was renting a trailer in Wentzville, I think.
Okay, maybe that's just the part I remember, was something with his mom. Okay.
Yeah, could be.
It was just near his mother's house.
Yeah. at some point in the 90s, Cox moved to Colorado, where he arranged in January 2003 to meet up with a girl he believed to be 14. Cox had emailed the girl asking her to be his sex slave.
Ugh.
The girl was actually an undercover federal agent.
Yeah!
He was arrested, and police seized his computer, which held around 45,000 images of child pornography. During the investigation...
for, like, extra storage space?
Apparently.
What the fuck?
That's a lot.
He probably had, like, an extra hard drive.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
What the fuck? That's probably right, actually.
Yeah.
How do you even get, like, how do you get that far in and not already be caught? Like, that mm-hmm. is so many downloads or visits or whatever to these sites. How did you get away with it for that long?
I mean, this is 2003. Okay, so
I'm forgetting. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know I had a computer early because my dad was like, we have to get a computer. So I had a computer like by the time I was in high school. I think I was in middle school when we got a computer, actually. But computers weren't in every house until probably closer to 2000, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I didn't get a computer in my house until I was 14 or 15.
Oh, we definitely had a computer. Mm-mm. I want to say, I remember at middle school.
My friends had
some. I graduated 07.
So that's, I mean, that's quite a bit.
That is still after 2000, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, like I didn't buy my first computer. Like, so the one that I had was like Windows 2.0, like, I mean, a fucking old ass computer, whatever it was. And I didn't buy my first computer until I was going to college. So I had the one that my dad bought when I was in the sixth grade, and that was it, because you couldn't fucking afford computers back then.
Yeah.
I think my desktop was definitely over a grand, and it wasn't a great computer. So, you know, so it was a little different at that time. Which is hard to remember sometimes.
I know, I have because of what it looks like now. Where you're like, wait a minute.
We've come a long way.
This is how it's right. 2000.
It's even hard for us who lived through it. Like, I mean, say, and like, that's why, like I say in all the episodes, like, we didn't have cell phones then. Yeah. I'm also reminding me, because I'm so used to having a cell phone now, that I sometimes forget that, like, my first cell phone didn't have voicemail or didn't have caller ID, mm-hmm. you know, or any of those things. Like, all that stuff was totally different then. Sometimes it's really easy to forget those things or not think about them that way. So during the investigation, authorities learned that Cox was the administrator of an online child pornography ring.
Okay.
He was scheduled to be released in 2011.
Of course.
But he was...
got off early?
Oh, no. You'll be happy this time. You'll be happy. Oh, he was certified as a sexually dangerous person under the Adam Walsh Act. Oh, I just got goosebumps. The act allows for a civil commitment, which is when a person is kept incarcerated beyond their sentence if a panel determines they're highly likely to reoffend.
Fuck yes.
Cox.
And that can be infinite?
I think so, yeah. So he was supposed to release in 2011, and when they figured out who he was in, what did I just say, 2019, he was still in prison, even though he was supposed to be released in 2011 because of the Adam Walsh Act.
Oh,
how many other girls did this man kill?
They don't think any.
What?
They think just Angie.
There's no fucking
way. Every other girl that they know that he abused, he knew. She's just apparently the one. And then,
but the way he did it was fucking horrific,
terrible, absolutely awful. Yeah, he's a piece of shit.
Why her?
Is he still alive?
We have a little bit of an answer to why her, not really an answer to why her, but he is still alive. So Cox was charged with kidnapping, sodomy, and first-degree murder for what he did to Angie. The kidnapping charge was later dropped because the grand jury failed to indict him on that charge. I have no idea why. I couldn't find any information. It doesn't make any fucking sense, but okay. It doesn't really matter, I guess, because he's in prison, but still.
Fuck that guy.
Right, completely. Fuck that guy. Upon Cox's arrest, more information came out about what happened to Angie. Just a little bit still. Cox had used a torn piece of Angie's underwear as a gag, which was found beneath the duct tape that covered her mouth. So there's that little fucking gross tidbit of information. What a piece of shit. Angie also had deep lacerations to both of her wrists and her right thigh. I'm not sure if that was from trying to escape or if that was something he did. They say a lot that she was tortured, but they haven't said like what that entails other than, you know, obviously the things that we know. She was not fed or given anything to drink. She, you know, obviously she was sexually assaulted probably a lot. But police believe she struggled aggressively against her bindings in an effort to escape. So, I mean, her wrists obviously could be from that. I don't know about her thigh, you know, how she was tied to the tree or whatever, but again, that's all that they had.
Cuts or lacerations?
It said lacerations.
Okay.
Deep lacerations to both of her wrists and her right thigh. Hmm. Investigators tracked down one of the girls from the attack in Overland, who must have been in her late 30s at that time, just based on how old she was in that attack, and she agreed to testify against Cox. Cox was charged with another 4 counts of sodomy in that case. In that case, he entered an Alford plea and received 4 sentences of 10 years each to be served concurrently. So basically an extra 10 years since they'd be served concurrently. But it doesn't, I mean, he's in prison for the rest of his life, so it's more of a giving justice to those girls, really, than it is, you know, a sentence to keep him in prison.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Not that I'm saying that means it doesn't matter. It absolutely matters. Yeah. It's very important. Those girls absolutely deserve justice as well. But, you know, at the very least, he is in prison for the rest of his life, which is hopefully long and painful. Cox originally entered a plea of not guilty. Then in August of, in August of 2020, a plea deal changed that plea to guilty. In exchange, Cox would avoid the death penalty and would give a confession to what he did to Angie. St. Charles County Prosecutor Tim Lomar said, quote, "He does deserve the death penalty. He deserves a worse fate than what he gave to Angie." Instead, Cox was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And her family did go and listen to what he did.
And they wanted the death penalty?
I don't know if they did or not. Oh. I would hope that they were given the choice. I would hope that they were given the choice, but I don't know for sure. The victim in the Overland case spoke at Cox's sentencing hearing, and she said, quote, "For me, tomorrow another day will come, and after that another will come. But for this sorry excuse for a human, today it ends. I will go on with my amazing life, with my amazing family, and you will rot in a lonely jail cell. No family, no friends, and most importantly, no more victims." She went on to say, quote, "I'm speaking to you as an advocate for all victims. We are strong and we are fierce. And today justice will be served for the crimes that you committed against me. If there's anything that I want heard today, it's that I was a victim. And I emphasize was. But I have overcome that and I will continue to be successful and I will continue to advocate for victims and speak out to have justice served." So...
Whoa.
To go and stand there and look at him and do that is just so incredibly brave and amazing.
Everybody should get that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't, like, I'm sure everyone couldn't do it.
Oh, absolutely.
So right. I think and just the just, fact that she was, and not that there's anything wrong with anybody who can't, of course, but just the fact that she was able to, wow.
I hope she got peace from that.
Yeah. There's one more trigger warning. I'm going to give a little more detail about what I could find of his confession. So it's not graphic, but that's the warning anyway. So Cox had been in the area near Angie's house that day and had some car trouble. He stopped to see what was going on and noticed the school bus stop. He saw Angie get out of the bus and then he approached her. He originally told police that she approached him, which was, of course, complete bullshit. Tim Lomar told Five on Your Side that lying about those kinds of details is common with pedophiles. Quote, "In their own minds, they probably have to figure out a way to live with themselves, and so they just have to minimize things and sort of distance themselves from the bad things that they've done to these kids."
Or they're just fucking piece of shit liars.
Right.
This is what a fuck is.
ladies earlier. Yes, Mark Conversation. He's a fuck. Yeah, he's a fuck. Fuck. Cox asked Angie if she was hungry, and she said she was. So Cox convinced her to climb into his orange sedan before driving off with her.
Oh.
He took her to Burger King to get food before driving around for a while, possibly even hours. Then Cox took Angie back to the mobile home he was renting in Wentzville, where he assaulted her and kept her captive. He had a live-in girlfriend who was questioned, but police were satisfied with her responses that she did not know Angie was in the trailer. She told detectives that she lived in fear of Cox, who forbid her from entering the back bedroom, and that she worked odd hours. The woman was from another country and spoke broken English at that time, which I would imagine added to her fear of this man. Because where's she going to go? What's she going to do? Yeah. At some point, Cox had a stroke, which led Lomar to believe that details of the crime had been erased from his memory. I would say it's also possible that he's lying about remembering things because he's probably been reliving this disgusting, monstrous abuse over and over in his head. So, I don't know that I believe that he doesn't remember what happened. Mm-hmm. Or that he doesn't remember parts of it.
Oh, definitely not.
Fuck him. So, Cox also told detectives that he left her hoping that someone would find her, which is just utter fucking bullshit. He left her naked.
You left her tied to a tree?
Yeah. He left her naked.
Find her in the middle of the woods?
In the freezing cold. He didn't fucking think anyone would just find her. Mm-mm. So just for giggles, I looked up the temperature for the day I think he left her there.
Maybe he wanted somebody to find her, but didn't necessarily want them to find her alive.
Right. So I looked up the temperature for the day I think he left her there, which I think is November 25th, 1993. The high was 49 degrees. Mm. The low was 0. Ooh. If I'm wrong and he left her there on the 26th, the high was 30 degrees and the low was 0. The day Angie was found, the high was 36 degrees. He didn't hope somebody would find her alive. Tim Lomar hit the nail on the head when he stated his belief that Cox hoped by the time anyone found Angie, there wouldn't be enough of her left to identify. In closing, fuck that guy. Mm. And fuck the other guy. And the other guy we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know I like to end with the focus back on the victims. There wasn't a whole lot available in this one. I think there's really not usually with kids. I think probably just because the parents must be so
perfect.
I mean, yeah. And they're so little, they haven't even gotten a chance to
fuck it all up.
To be somebody. I mean, not that they're not somebody, of course they are when they're right. 9 and 10,
but they're still coming into their humanness.
Exactly. They're still creating who they are and figuring out who they are. So I think maybe that's why. Also, I can't imagine if you're a parent of a young child who is murdered or dies tragically, then having to go and talk to the newspapers and tell them how amazing your kid is when you're just trying to fucking come to grips with the fact that your kid's never coming home. I can't fucking fathom it. We all have kids close to these ages, so that always makes it a little bit tougher. So Cassidy first. Cassidy was described by neighbors as a sweet girl with a bright smile who always wore pink. Cassidy's principal said she, quote, had a smile that would light up her whole face. She loved to write stories and was a good, steady student. I don't know who said this about her. I just have the sentence here that she loved to sing. A family member said, quote, she always laughed a lot. She loved to come down here to the country and she liked to help out on the farm. She was easy to tease and real affectionate. There were always lots of hugs. For her, everything was funny. Life was funny. Rhonda, Cassidy's mom, said Cassidy was, quote, my love and my life. Since my daughter was murdered, my life is empty. Surprisingly, as much as Angie was in the paper, there was, obviously with her case being unsolved for so long, there are a lot more articles about her, but there was less about who she was. At Angie's funeral, a letter from her great-grandmother was read that said, quote, it will be a lonely life for us when we won't be able to see your beautiful face. A family friend said, quote, the world doesn't know what it's missing without Angie. Angie's friend Ashley said, quote, I really miss her and I wish I could have her back. And Angie's little brother, Ron Jr., who was 2 when she was murdered, later said, quote, he says it there, I was 2 when she was taken. She was a big part of my life, so to have her taken away like that was taking my best friend away. Aww. And that is the horrifying story of the murders of Cassidy Center and Angie Houseman.
Rest in peace, you sweet girls.
I know, I'm so glad that they both got justice.
For 2 such just heinous crimes to be committed so close to each other by 2 different people.
It's just right.
Wild.
That's crazy, isn't it? And at the same time, I mean, you know, a lot of times with cases now, especially, and with true crime being what it is now, like, we get caught up in the, oh, well, it couldn't be this. Well, you think 2 people are doing this at the same time in the same area? Well, yeah, 3 were. I mean, it's maybe unlikely.
Right. But then are those men, is that like a maniacal thing they're doing where he saw that a girl got taken? So then they think, oh, well, now I'm going to do it. And they'll think that it's this other guy.
That's true. But I mean, it's, you know, we get caught up in that a lot. Like, oh, that didn't happen. Or I was reading, I don't remember what it was I was reading. Maybe it was one of their cases from before it got solved. Maybe it was Angie's, and it was from before it got solved because it was on Reddit. So obviously it would have had to have been her case, not Cassidy's. But it was, they were talking about like interviewing the dad, interviewing the stepdad kind of a thing. And they were like, well, of course they did, because strangers don't do this kind of stuff, blah, 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 blah. It's all, it's the parents. It's always someone, you know, it's always the family. And here we are. It was strangers in both cases.
Right.
It wasn't the family. And that doesn't mean that it's not the most likely thing. You right. still have to look at that. But to say, I know what happened because statistics show, shut the fuck up. Statistics don't cover every case. You gotta
cross everything off.
Absolutely. So it's just weird. People get so caught up on that stuff, but it could be, mm-hmm. those things do happen. There are situations where you've got multiple predators in one location. You know what? I shouldn't use the word predator. Someone had a really great TikTok about how predators is not a good word for that, but.
I could see how that.
But do you have, I mean, you do have more than one piece of shit in the same area harming one people sometimes. Fuck. Exactly. One fuck. More than one fuck harming people in the same area sometimes. So
it's also how you say it. You got to say it a certain way in order for it to be like a noun.
You like it, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She likes it. She's going to say that all the time now. Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for Maddie to tell his teacher that next.
Me either. I got to better practice my.
Mama told me to tell. You're a stupid fuck. I'm gonna
practice my baby didn't say that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But was that teacher being like a fuck?
She was a stupid right. fuck. Oh, that was horrible.
It was horrible.
That was heavy.
I feel like I've done a lot of cases involving children here recently, so I'm gonna do my best to not right. do that next time. Sorry, guys. I know that's rough.
Yes, please. Please, no less.
I think we need some survivor stories soon.
Yes. We did. I did. What was that? We just did one not very long ago.
A survivor story? Oh, that one's a really good one.
Mm-hmm. I like that one a lot.
We were just talking about that one earlier today. The burning book. You mean the burning bed?
Burning bed. The burning, you know.
Burning bed.
Burn the books.
You know. The burning rain of death.
Right. That was that one was. All right. You're gonna lighten the mood.
Yeah.
Please.
Jokes with Holly. Yeah, that's right. You look over there. What? Beth, this is for you.
Okay.
What do you call a pile of cats?
That's wet dream.
That sounded maybe not wet dream. Maybe not wet dream.
Best dream come true. That's what I meant.
Dream come true. That's better.
That's better. That's what I
thanks
meant.
For making the you sound like a creep wrong. That wants to fuck cats.
I regret I redact my first statement. That was wrong.
That's not what I meant.
Please lean into the microphone and tell them I don't want to fuck cats. That's what I
call a malaphore, and it's a real thing. Okay? And I suffer from them.
Yes. We have talked about look it up, guys.
Yeah. It's now thing. You know a new word. Maybe okay. That's my contribution all right. For this podcast.
Yep. All your malaphores. Thank you for that.
Or just learning a new word.
Okay,
way.
Well, now that we've gone there, what I don't know. What is
what
it?
What do you call what a is pile it? Of cats?
I don't know.
Wait, it's gotta be something vagina related. For sure.
I've done some pretty good vagina related things, I will say.
All right.
I don't know.
What do you call a pile of kittens? Kittens!
Wait.
Cats. Cats. What do you call a pile of cats? A meowton.
That wasn't vagina related.
No. Get it? Meowton.
Again.
Like a mountain.
Oh, it's so bad.
But it's cats.
I've taken these jokes. There's always so many dirty jokes. And honestly, I'm fucking tired of looking at fucking...
You want to know what Mason's joke is?
What?
Literally, this 12-year-old boy. Why did the orphan commit a crime?
Oh.
He wanted to be wanted. I'm like, oh, I hate it, but it's kind of funny.
You're like, fuck. Fuck yeah.
No.
Good times.
All right, you guys know where we are. We're at Mommy's Horror on all the socials.
Like the basement?
We're in the basement.
We're in the basement.
Basement in the dark.
Yeah.
We love you guys. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Sweet dreams, spookies.